You're listening to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, or maybe listen to our podcast on Audio Boom. This show is brought to you with the wonderful assistance of oldfootballshirts.com. This week, well, Lewis Dunk joined up with the England squad, but sadly never got to make his debut against either Croatia or Spain, or I suspect the hope springs eternal that he'll get his chance against the US sometime next month. Meanwhile, I took a trip up to the stadium to have a natter for the first time in a long time with the chief executive of Albion in the Community, Matt Dawn.
Now, it's been a while since we've had anyone from AITC on, and certainly the boss of AITC, so give us a bit of a background first about yourself.
Okay, yeah, so I've been working primarily in the sort of sport, leisure and education sector for the last 20 years, primarily really using sport as a tool to drive positive change in the community. My background is I am a teacher and an assessor and an internal verifier, so I have an affiliation with education and being able to see the benefits.
Assessor and what?
An assessor and an internal verifier. So
what
effectively
does that mean?
That means that you can assess different types of work within the apprenticeship programmes.
Okay.
But yeah, being able to really see the difference that football as a catalyst can really provide to people in the communities of Sussex.
Sure. So when you were a teacher, what was your subject?
PE, funnily
naturally,
enough. Naturally.
Yeah.
So yeah, primarily when I started with Albion in the Community, I sort of headed up the education department and worked within the curriculum. And it was very much delivering a whole raft of different qualifications from education in level 2 BTECs, level 3 diplomas in sports, apprenticeships, vocational studies, that sort of thing.
Okay, I mean, so tell us about your history at Albion Community. How did you get to make the jump from teacher to AITC bod?
So I've always been working pretty much within the sport, leisure and education sector. I've had an affiliation with football my whole life. So when the opportunity...
Are you a Brighton fan by birth?
Brighton fan by birth,
good
yeah.
Man.
Born and raised locally, so always had an affiliation with Brighton naturally. So yeah, when the opportunity came up for me to join Albion in the Community full time, I jumped at it with both hands. So primarily I've been here now for 7 years. Various different roles. As I said, I started out working in the education team, then became obviously the head of education before moving into a role as general manager. And then obviously with the sad and tragic passing of Gary, who at the time was obviously the chief executive.
Gary Townsend, we're talking here.
So I ended up doing the role as an interim first for 3 months and then obviously took it on a full-time basis back in November 16, and that's where we are today.
Sure. So, and you've taken on quite a project here because, I mean, we've had Albion and the Community people on before, and they've all sort of hinted at its vastness. And we've always tried to get a handle on this. And we know this is something of which every Brighton fan can be proud of because this is all done in the name of their favourite football club. Mm-hmm. But try and give us a flavour, if you can, of the scope of Albion Community.
Okay, yeah, I mean, Albion in the Community basically uses the power of football as a tool to inspire children and young people and adults to try and achieve their goals and fulfil their potential. And we do that by delivering high quality, accessible opportunities which improve people's health, their well-being, their education, their aspirations. So the breadth and depth of what we do is vast. We've mm-hmm. been around for well over 25 years, starting out in 1990 primarily as a football education type programme and going out into the communities and delivering football as a catalyst for change to now delivering 60 programmes on an annual basis.
60?
60 programmes.
We'll go through those in a minute, but carry on.
So we are broad in terms of what we do and we've been long established, but what we're always trying to do is more. And we need the fan support and we need the support of our stakeholders and funders and organisations so that we can continue to sustain the projects that we deliver and also so we can try and drive new programmes so we can give more people within Sussex the opportunity to get involved in sport.
Okay, right, I'm going to ask the big rundown now. Tell us about the various departments within AITC and what it is they do.
Okay, I mean, what we've tried to move away from is having sort of departments, if you like, and what we actually have now is multiple projects that fall within 6 independent but very interlinked strategic pillars. So all the work that we do now falls under the headings of active participation, inspiring supporters, personal development, raising aspirations, community improvement and supporting our stakeholders. And effectively, those programmes that we deliver are to try to solve social issues and improve the communities in which we serve. So we introduced that into our new strategy. That new strategy basically enabled us to try and improve the communities that we serve and give us, if you like, a platform to be able to deliver a plethora of different programmes, whether it be within health, education, disability, inclusion. There's a whole raft, if you like, of programmes that we can offer.
Sure. So, I mean, I think probably two of the Albion's favourites are very much involved in this. Now, we had them on the show earlier this year, but tell us how Guy and Danny, Guy Butters and Danny Culliper, are involved in this. Because, I mean, in the middle of this, everyone says, oh, they work for Albion, the community. But you're the one that actually probably, you know, whips them into shape.
Well, hopefully. Danny and Guy have been with us for a long time. They're huge advocates for the work that we do. Primarily, their day-to-day role entails them to work within the education and football department. Mm-hmm. So we have around 84 to 85 full-time scholars that are based on our programmes who get involved in full-time educational studies and either compete in 11-a-side football or futsal. Danny and Chris basically run our futsal, Chris Day.
Okay.
So they run our futsal practical sessions and the match day fixtures. And then Guy Butters and John Miller run our 11-a-side programmes as well. So it's a discipline that basically combines either futsal or futsal with their education studies. And then also they're heavily instrumental in getting involved in our fundraising activities, our annual European cycle tour, which you will have seen Danny and Guy on this year. So yeah, they're huge advocates for the work that we do, and the work that they do is absolutely absolutely fantastic.
Now, we're having this conversation in the stadium, and you know, now and again you sort of, people can pop in and out, and obviously go into Dick's Bar, it's open all the time. And when I've been into the Dick's Bar during the day, it's kind of strange to see Guy and Danny, two of the sort of like the biggest lumbering but big-hearted centre halves that this club has ever had, walking around with clipboards and files. It's it's quite a gear crunch, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think it's fair to say that we get them to do many IT-based operations. they are old school in nature, but that's fine. We know exactly how they operate, and they bring a huge USP to that particular programme.
Yeah.
But yes, they will be seen regularly with their clipboards, sorting out the formations for their teams for the week, doing all the registers and attendances, liaising with the boys, and they do a lot of player welfare as well. So that entails sort of meeting up with the boys, finding out how they're doing, if they've got any concerns, and then that can feed through to their teachers who deliver their academics as well.
I mean, this is, you're raising a sort of point, an extra point here, because what you're talking about is football as a conduit for enhancing and bettering people's lives, absolutely. But there's also aspects of it where the football kind of takes a back seat, and because you have education and social inclusion programmes, that you've also got to have people who are involved on that level of sort of well-being and mental well-being as well, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, football is the catalyst for social change, and obviously it's at the bedrock of everything we do. But yeah, I mean, we employ 60 full-time core staff, and they all bring a unique skills sort of matrix with them. They've got a raft of experience, knowledge and competency. And yeah, of course, football is obviously why we exist. We exist because we're Brighton and Hove Albion's official charity, and without them we wouldn't be here. But ultimately, we have to make sure we have the right skill set in all of the areas that we operate so that we can be the best in that field.
I mean, another aspect of the Albion community, which is, again, we've had him on the show, and we've had the teammates on the show, is the disability unit. And we've got Paul Brackley running a kind of a very vast but also very public network, especially when it comes to the power chair team.
Yeah, I mean, Paul's done an amazing job in terms of raising the profile of all of the disability provision that we offer. We have 30 regular teams that participate on a weekly basis. We have around 500 participants that are involved in that. We have four national teams, of which the power chair team are one of them, who all operate at the highest level of their discipline. So the disability we work, the work that we do is phenomenal. And actually, you know, we are always trying to put on more events, whether it be for our amputee squads, for our Down syndrome team, for our cerebral palsy team, for our deaf team. And that's for both genders. It's for men and women. It's for girls and boys.
Combined.
It can be combined. It can be separate. I mean, we have a lot of women and girls programmes, which we can talk about later on, that we're trying to increase on. But the work that Paul's team have done within that sphere is huge.
Sure. So, I mean, one of the fundraising things that I'm kind of partially involved in, that happens every year, is the Julie Hodder Cup. The power chair wheelchair tournament. And anyone in future, I'd say this to anyone who does actually want to go, it's an open event, it's held as an indoor event in July, thanks Steve Darby, well done. It's American Express get involved, Chaney Heritage get involved, Albion the community get involved, and you can see the power chair team playing football. And if you get a chance to watch them do play, you know, playing, do. And the other thing you'll see is the likes of Guy Butters and Danny Culliver trying to recreate a demolition derby. But one chap, and we do have to mention him from the sad news this week, who always supported and always gave his all towards it, is Peter Brackley. So give us a flavour of what Peter Brackley was for Albion, the community.
Yeah. Peter's been, you know, massively beneficial to the charity. He was a huge supporter of our work. I mean, the Julie Hodder Cup that you spoke about, his wit, his enthusiasm was there and evident for everyone to see. I was fortunate enough to go down this year and see the event in operation. In fact, I think Martin Perry even got in the chair and did a showcase piece as well.
With some Peter Brackley commentary in the background.
Absolutely, with some Peter Brackley commentary, yeah. And what he's, you know, he was just a huge advocate for the work that we did, and he'd be sorely missed. Mm. He was a particular and close friend of Guy Butters, and the two of them were instrumental in laying on the Goldstone 20 Years On event for us that we had last year.
Well,
it was fantastic. Yeah. So, our thoughts are with his family at this current time.
Absolutely. So tell us about Albion Community 2018. Like you say, it's been going for 25 years, and I'd say last time we had anyone on, there was this project, that project, mm-hmm. and obviously these things... they evolve and they change, and this is so. Where are we at the moment?
We're always developing. We're always looking at the different communities that we serve. I mean, the new strategic plan that we've got that takes us through to 2021 is to really try and look at those six independent pillars that I alluded to earlier, and look at how we can be a force for positive change. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do more and more of is be that catalyst and work in conjunction with key stakeholders, so that we can really try and understand those communities and try and put some additional programs into those that we're already running. We're always looking at the governance of the charity and making sure that all the programs that we run and deliver are to the highest quality. Hopefully that's evident again that we've been put forward this year at the Football Business Awards as best community scheme in the Premier League. So we're always striving to do more and to do better. The trustees are heavily involved in the work that we do. They come out and they visit the programmes. They're really, really involved. So we're always looking at the different programmes that we deliver and how we can hopefully do more of that and create more opportunities for people to get involved in.
So give us an example as to who the stakeholders would be.
There's a raft of stakeholders. I mean, the biggest stakeholder naturally is obviously Brighton and Hove Albion Football Club. Mm-hmm. The relationship we have with them is really, really close. We work very closely together on a multitude of different areas. Obviously, American Express, again, are huge supporters of our work. And again, we're also up at the Football Business Awards for the best corporate or CSR program in conjunction with American Express. And we do a whole raft of work with their volunteer program. There's obviously lots of schools, there's the council, the CCG, there's a whole plethora. Obviously the council department within Brighton and Hove. So there's a whole raft of stakeholders and partners that we work with. And actually, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be able to deliver the work that we do and sustain that.
Sure. Now, you mentioned earlier, you touched on it, and let's expand on this. You said that you've got active programmes to try and get women and girls into the community schemes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, women and girls is one of the areas that we're trying to increase. So one of our areas within the strategy is to increase women and girls' participation by 15% year on year. As we currently stand at the moment, we're actually 50% on participation levels up comparative to that of last year. So it's an area for us that we're heavily trying to do more work in. We link up very well with the Women and Girls RTC, so the regional training centres, in terms of our elite pathway and trying to feed girls through into that particular programme. We've had a whole host of girls that have been selected to do so. We work very closely with Hope and Kirsty within the women's football team. Laura Rafferty is obviously an ambassador for the programme, and we'll touch on the ambassadors later. So we're trying to do lots of work in that area. And actually, being in the Premier League, one of the biggest benefits that the charity has seen is obviously the brand's increase for the club. And as a result of that, we have more people that want to engage and embark on our programmes and our projects. And a lot of that is women and girls.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, when you're talking about the uptake that the girls are having within the community scheme, obviously there's something like the women's team being in the WSL and the pathway for girls to women's football as well. How much hard work did it take for girls to actually get involved in the scheme, or were they sort of like queuing up at the door to say, can we have something?
I think it's an amalgamation of both. I mean, we've always had women and girls involved in Albion in the Community's programmes, but I think you're right. I think the fact that the women's team have now entered the WSL1 has really raised the profile of that. I think, and it's an exciting time for women and girls. You know, the England team have got the World Cup, they've got the Olympics, they've got the Euros within the next 3 years.
Mm.
So we're hoping that, you know, off the back of that, it's going to generate interest. We work in 140-odd schools, 148 schools across Sussex, and one of the things that we do is try and get more women and girls involved in active participation, health and wellbeing programmes, but we also do education studies in programmes such as Code Girls, which is trying to get more girls involved in looking at STEM subjects and particularly IT, and take that as an option when they go into sort of year 9 and 10. So we've always had women and girls involved in our programmes, but I think the fact that the women's team here at Brighton & Hove Albion has really increased and the profile's increased has actually helped in terms of people actively wanting to participate and get involved in sport more so than ever before, really.
Talking about ambassadors just now that we know that you've got three ambassadors now, so, and I believe that you're just about to announce a new one.
We are, yeah. So I'm pleased to announce that Matty Ryan is now going to be our Winning the Community's men's first team ambassador. Mm-hmm. We're absolutely delighted to have Matty come on board. We've been very fortunate in the past to have the services of both Liam Rossini and Inigo Calderon and David Stockdale. So adding Matty to that list is phenomenal for us as a charity, and we really welcome and thank him for the support and the generosity that he's going to bring to the table for the charity.
Apart from just running up and down the pitch every time we score.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, look, he's a fan's favourite. I don't think there was any question as to who we wanted to try and get in as an ambassador for Albion in the community, and alongside...
Oh, he is that sort of, you know, enthusiastic. He's like a kid in a toy shop, isn't he?
He is, and you know, he understands the work that Albion in the community does. He understands the difference that we can make to people's lives locally, and he's very community-driven. I think that's evident at the end of every match when you can see him distributing different pieces of memorabilia to the fans.
Even to Manchester City fans, coming from Australia.
He's a great advocate for the sport, and actually he's a great role model, and I'm hugely grateful for him accepting the position of coming on board with both Laura Rafferty, who's going to continue for another year, and obviously JD as well, who's been with us for a number of years now.
I was about to say, tell us about what the work that JD Yeselada has been doing for the Albion community.
Yeah, so JD's been with us since he was 8 years old, obviously was involved in participating in wheelchair football when it first begun. He then obviously went through and did his level 2 activity leadership qualification with us, and he's been with us ever since. The main work that JD tends to operate now is he works very much with our fundraising department, but also with our schools department. He goes into schools and delivers messages around how people can get actively involved in participating in sport. He talks about his journey and the barriers that he's faced and how he's been able to overcome those. And then he also gets involved in fundraising events and how schools, for example, can get involved in different campaigns like our Blue and White Day. And he speaks to the children about what they could do as part of that fundraising campaign. And he goes into a lot of SEND schools and mainstream schools as well, just to talk about the work that Albion in the community does and how they can all get involved.
And what does Laura do as well?
Laura's been fantastic since she's been an ambassador for Albion in the community. So she's been out to multiple different events. You'll have seen her out in the public domain recently when she obviously went along to our Match of the Day piece that we did, which was around one of our cancer programmes, Brighter Outlook, that was delivered down on the actual seafront.
Ken Velder was on that. We had Ken
on the show a few weeks ago. Ken was on that as well. And again, she does lots of things as well behind the scenes. It isn't always just about an ambassador going out and doing player appearances. It's retweeting and advocating different campaigns that we have on social media. It's going out and meeting some of the participants. It's doing question and answer sessions. So Laura's been absolutely phenomenal in the work that she's done. She's done a lot of stuff with her peers and her colleagues from the women's team and going out around our health programmes as well. So we're very, very fortunate and grateful for all of the work that they do for us.
Sure. Now, next week, we're at home to Wolverhampton Wanderers, and we've got something called an AITC takeover. So tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have an annual community takeover day, which is about trying to raise for the fans their understanding and knowledge around the different projects and programmes that we deliver and hopefully how they can get involved in those. But ultimately for us as well, it's a fundraising opportunity and a bucket collection. So we kindly will have lots of volunteers who have, as I say, kindly donated their time to come along and bucket collect. We've got different activities that will be taking place on the outer perimeters of the concourses. We're asking people really to donate £1 or any change that they possibly can into any of those buckets that will help us to sustain the programmes that we deliver across Sussex and hopefully to also set up some new programmes as well. The charity actually costs around £3 million a year to run. That's equivalent of around £8,000 a day. So the support we receive from fans on days such as these are hugely beneficial to us. And in advance, just thank you for all the support. And we need that to continue so that we can sustain that work across Sussex.
So I assume that you'd rather people drop paper into the bucket rather than coins just because it's lighter and easier for the collectors to carry.
Of course, and especially the red kind of paper as
well. Of course. The one that's going to have Harry Kane on a unicorn on it, yes. Great stuff. Well, you know, if people do want to drop a few quid in the buckets, it will be much appreciated. So, Matt, just to wrap up now, what's the rest of 2018 and into 2019 looking for Albion Community? What have you got in the pipeline?
Do you know what? It's very much doing a lot more of what we do. It's about trying to deliver and sustain those high quality sort of accessible opportunities that I mentioned earlier around health and wellbeing and education and raising aspirations. It's about trying to create opportunities. It's trying to use football to be the catalyst for social change. And effectively, the more that we can do, the more people that we can reach across Sussex and the more people that we can get involved in our programme. So for us, it's about trying to deliver more intelligent interventions to help raise people's aspirations and for us to continue to do all the good work that the charity provides.
Great stuff. And if anyone wants to get involved in any Albion Community schemes or wants to get in contact with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, by all means, have a look at the website. So go to www.albionincommunity.org.uk or contact us on 01273 878 260. Or again, all the details are on the website. There's a whole raft of different programmes that we provide. By all means, as I say, at next weekend's game, if you want to come and speak to some of the volunteers or the members of staff, they'll be in bright orange shirts, so hopefully you can't miss them. And again, we can obviously take your contact details down, but there's so many different opportunities for people to get involved in the breadth and depth of what the charity does, and we would welcome more people to get involved in that way.
Yeah, that was Matt Dawn, Chief Executive of Albion and the Community there. Last week, you may remember, Jared Evans and Russell Guyver had a good old quiz off, first part of the second episode of A Question of Raw. Here comes the second part, mostly about football generally. To the second part of the second edition of A Question of Raw with me, Alan Wares. I've still got Jared Evans and Russell Guyver. Russell, who's actually got a battering in the first half there in the Brighton and Hove Albion round, not getting his basics right. So the current score is 12 to Jared, 4 to Russell. Russell has stopped crying now. He's also dried out his underpants and put some new ones on, and we're all good to go. This second round is going to be a round all about general football stuff. So here we go. And I think what we'll do is we'll start with Russ this time, just in case he thought I was cheating. Russell.
Yes.
Your first question on this general football round. How tall in feet are the goalposts?
8 foot.
2 points. Oh. So for the first time in anything going, you're ahead of Jared. Jared, your question. How wide is the crossbar? Or how wide is a goal?
Is it 8 foot?
It's not 8 feet.
12?
No, the answer is 8 yards. That's 24 feet. So a goal is 3 times the width as it is its height. Your second question, Russell Guyver. After Messi and Ronaldo leading the way with 5 European Footballers of the Year / Ballon d'Or titles each, 3 players are tied on 3 wins each. Name any one of them. And we are going back to 1956 here, so...
Right.
That was before I was born.
And this is for me, yeah?
Yes, it's for you.
I'm going to go back in time, actually, and try one of the early ones. Di Stefano?
It's not Di Stefano. Jared, could you nick a point here?
Johan Cruyff?
Johan Cruyff is good for one. And your question, Jared Evans. Name any one of the other two.
Platini.
Platini for 2 points as well. And the third one, any guesses, guys?
Beckenbauer?
Zidane?
No, Beckenbauer only won it twice. The other one who won it 3 times was Marco van Basten. Okay. Russell, your third question. Which player has scored most goals for England in the World Cup finals?
All together. Right. I'm going to say... Oh, that's a tough one, actually. Accumulated. Maybe I'll just plump for Gary Lineker.
I think it's a fairly easy one to go for. 2 points.
Yeah, it's good.
It's a difficult one.
I wasn't sure.
In what way was it difficult?
In the way that I'm finding all of this so difficult. Easy ones feel difficult now. It's a bit like a striker or form, really. I can spoon over the bar from 2 yards of length.
That's what happens when you support the Albion. Jared, your question. Who is England's second top scorer at World Cup finals tournaments?
Bobby Charlton.
It's not Bobby Charlton. There's a chance for a point here, Russ.
Alan Shearer?
No, the answer is Harry Kane, with all six that he scored this year. Russ, your fourth question. In which city is the club of Honved?
Right, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's Hungary. So I'm going to just go for Budapest.
Budapest is correct. Yep. 2 points. In which city, Jared, is the club of Real Betis?
We stumble in with this one.
It's Basque. Is it Basque? Not that I know any Basque country cities anyway. I don't know, Madrid.
It's not Madrid. Ross, do you fancy a bonus point?
I do for this one, yeah. Sevilla.
Sevilla, it is. Yeah. They are, I think, probably arguably the first team in Sevilla. I mean, they certainly seem to have equal rank.
Yeah, a pretty big club.
Russ, question five. The Fairs Cup, Intercities Cup, UEFA Cup and Europa League. Let's all put them all together. Even though UEFA don't recognise the Fairs Cup and Intercities Cup as their own tournaments, but I am including them back to their inauguration in 1958. How many English clubs have made it to the final? And I'll give you one either way.
Okay, so there's a few. Liverpool, Fulham...
I love the way he talks about his answer, and, you know, as if you're not listening.
I've put my fingers in my ears.
Yeah. What else?
I'm going to hazard a guess at around about six.
Is that your answer?
Yeah.
I can't. Can't give you that. There's a bonus point for you, Jared. How many English clubs have made it to the various connotations of the UEFA Cup / Europa League final?
Eight.
The answer is 12.
Oh.
12. And I'm going to list them. Arsenal, Birmingham City, Chelsea, Fulham, Ipswich, Leeds, Liverpool, Man United, Middlesbrough, Newcastle, Spurs and Wolves. Spurs and Wolves in the same year, actually. Jared, the European Cup Winners' Cup, formerly a tournament. How many English clubs have made it to the final? And again, I'm going to give you one either way.
Five.
I'm going to throw that one over to Russ.
I don't think it's many more than that, so I'll say seven.
So close to a point, and yet so far, the answer is nine.
Oh.
That's Arsenal, Chelsea, Everton, Leeds, Liverpool, Man City, Man United, Spurs and West Ham.
Hitting the crossbar now, I am.
You are, but not quite good enough. Question six. Russell Guyver. Where will this season's Europa League final take place? In which city?
Europa League final. I don't have any ideas, so I'm going to have to just throw a complete stab in the dark out here. I'll just say Glasgow.
It's not Glasgow. Jared, do you fancy nicking a point here?
Not really.
Well, just name a city then that isn't Basingstoke.
I'm going to say Seville.
No, it's not Seville. Of all places, it's Baku.
No.
Long way away. Nearly not in Europe. In fact, totally not in Europe, but, you know, for some reason.
Who's squabbling about it, eh?
Your question six. In which city will this season's Champions League final take place?
Is it Madrid?
It is Madrid. Good man. But okay. not at the Bernabeu. It's at the...
Metropolitano.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Although there's a good chance that Real Madrid will get there anyway. So, question seven to you, Russ. Now, we're going back to... a long way back in... We were talking to the 1880s here. What is the name of the body in world football who are the guardians of the laws of the game? In other words, who makes the laws of the game?
I'm going to go for what I think is the obvious answer. I might be wrong. FIFA?
It's not FIFA. Jared?
Is it the Football Association?
It's not. It's the International Football Association Board.
I mean, that's halfway there.
Yes, but not quite. I did ask for the name of them, not anything else. Jared, your question. There are five bodies represented on IFAB. Name any one of them.
UEFA.
Not UEFA. Russ?
I'm going to say that the referees have got to have some sort of heavy input. So is there a referees federation?
I cannot believe how you two managed to dance right into the middle of the custard. No. The answer is FIFA, the FA, the FA of Wales, the Scottish FA and the FA of Ireland. Russ, question eight. How wide in yards is the penalty area?
How wide? About.
Well, I'm not interested in about, mate.
It's going to be exactly 20 yards?
No, it's not. Jared, do you know how wide a penalty area is? And when I say wide, I mean side to side, not goal line to edge. We know it's 18 yards. How wide is it?
I reckon he's not too far off. I reckon 24?
The answer is 44.
Oh.
So he was quite far
off. I was quite far off.
Quite way out, yeah, actually. And Jared, your question 8. How wide in yards is the goal area, more colloquially known as the 6-yard box?
20.
For 2 points. Mm. I bet you wish you had that question.
Yeah, yeah, I would have actually said 20 again.
Yeah, no,
for that answer.
Just that
one,
yeah. Yes.
Of course I would.
Right, question 9. Russell Guyver. We're back to the Albion here, actually.
Yeah.
Who is the only ex-Brighton player to go on and manage a league-winning side in England? And this is before Jared was born. Mm. That he was a player.
I think this is Howard Wilkinson.
Howard Wilkinson for 2 points. And Jared, your question. This is probably a lot harder, but I don't care. Who is the only ex-Brighton player to manage an FA Cup-winning side? Got to be honest with you, this is a tricky one. You do well to get it.
Absolutely no idea. I don't even know what former Brighton players have become managers.
Well, this is before you were born, yeah. Okay.
Before I was born as well. So I'm going to go for an absolute stab in the dark, and it's not going to be right, but Alan Kirbishley.
No.
I don't suppose there's any clues as to how far back this might go.
I would have offered that to Jared first, actually, to be fair.
Well, I thought I'd see if I could poach a goal there. This is probably going to be too tough to call, but I'll... ex-Brighton player that went on to manage... FA Cup-winning side. Not even sure I can come up with a name, really, at the moment. Yeah, I'm not... Absolutely no idea.
The answer is Dave Sexton, who managed Chelsea in 1970. Right. Sorry, bit of a stinker, that one. Look at me like I care. And finally, a fairly random question, but I'm going to ask it nonetheless. Question 10, Russell Guyver. Which Swedish footballer was awarded an honorary MBE in 2006?
Could that be someone like Freddie Ljungberg?
Not Freddie Ljungberg. Jared, you fancy a stab at this one?
Zlatan.
No. The answer is Henrik Larsson. Henrik Larsson. Mm. And Jared, your last torturous piece of torture.
It has been torture.
Well, it has been in the second half, fair enough. But the first half, you breezed it.
Yeah.
Frankly, so. Yeah. Which Danish footballer was awarded an honorary MBE in 2001?
Peter Schmeichel.
Peter Schmeichel finishes off this quiz for 2 points quite handsomely. And at the end of that general knowledge of football round, Jared Evans 9, Russell Guyver 9. Combine that with the Albion round, that means that Jared Evans has 21 and Russell Guyver has 13. So this week's winner is Jared. Well done, mate.
Thank you.
Well done.
Yes. So thanks very much to Jared and Russ. That is the end of the second episode of A Question of Raw. I hope it's been as challenging for you as it has for me. And we'll be back soon. So catch you later. Cheers. Yeah, congratulations, Jared. Great stuff. Well played, sir. Commiserations, Russell. You have to bear in mind that Russell was actually going to be a team member on a quiz called Football Genius on ITV4, but they didn't want us. You're listening to the Albion Raw in association with oldfootballshirts.com on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB+, on our podcast on Audio Boom. Earlier this week, we hosted Spencer Vignes's book launch for Bloody Southerners, his book about Brian Clough and Peter Taylor's time at the Albion. Few faces from yesteryear came along to the Caxton Arms near Brighton Station, Brett Mendoza's pub, for the book launch. Plenty of books sold, much beer drunk, and good time had. We caught up with Peter O'Sullivan, but first, let's hear from Albion defender from the early 70s, Ian Goodwin. Ian, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Alan. I have two new knees.
Yes.
I have U-pins in my back, and I broke my finger. That aside,
well, tonight, and this is just from tonight.
The last 2 years have been pretty hellish.
Okay, so you're Steve Austin, a man barely alive. You are the $6 million man.
No, I think the operation's worked out about 30 grand's worth.
Okay, so here we are at the book launch of Spencer Bugness's book, Bloody Southerners, about Clough and Taylor's time at the Albion. And you're quite well interviewed in the book. So tell us how you came to be at the Albion in the first place.
Well, I started my career in football at 15. I left home and joined Oldham Athletic under Jimmy McElroy as an apprentice professional. At 17, Mr. McElroy decided I wasn't good enough. So I went off back to the little village I lived in on the banks of the Manchester Ship Canal and worked for 9 months in the steel industry. I went to Coventry to pick my brother up. My brother was on trial at Coventry. I went to pick him up to bring him home. Played in half a game. Ended up staying for a month's trial and signed for Coventry. It was there that I worked under Pat Saywood, who, for me, was the best coach I've ever met in my life. Tremendous coach. Played for Coventry, made half a dozen games for the first team. And Pat phoned me up and asked would I come down on loan, help him out. Delighted to come to Brighton, loved my time here, enjoyed playing with the side. When the opportunity came to join them on a full-time basis, it was great, I loved it. Thoroughly enjoyed my time here, went through a few injuries, both cartilages done.
So what year are we talking about that you joined?
I came down in, I think it was 71.
Okay.
70, 71, something like that.
Sure. And tell us about the sort of like the player that you were back in those days.
Robust.
Robust. We're talking a central defender here.
Yeah, I played at the back, yeah.
Right, alongside?
I played with Norman Gore.
Sure, Sir Norman.
Lovely guy. Really good guy. I mean, I now think, had I learned Geordie, I might have well continued under Mr. Clough, but... You know, I think he classed me as a southern softie.
Right, even yes.
But, you know, I'm a Mancunian in the end of the day.
But you were part of the 72 promotion winning side.
Yeah, I came into the side. I'd been out with a cartilage operation, couldn't get back in the side. They were going great guns. Had a few hiccups, and Pat decided that, I think it was Good Friday, for the Good Friday game against Aston Villa, I was going to come in to mark Andy Lockhead. Came into the side, I think we then went 13 games without defeat, and as we all know, finished second to Villa in the league. And I just loved the place, really. I'd got 3 years left on my contract when Clough arrived, but it took me probably about 10 minutes to decide that he wasn't for me.
What was it about Clough? I mean, obviously this huge international man of mystery. Or hysteria, I can't work out which one it is. But what was it about him that actually rubbed you up the wrong way?
I think it was his arrogance.
Lack of honesty?
He was a cheat. You know, to go to Leeds and call people cheats. You know, he cheated. He never ran a training session. His tactics... I sat on the bench for my last game at Huddersfield. In those days, we went onto the pitch with... 5 minutes before the kick-off, had a little run round. I collect the tracksuits, go and sit on the bench. Cluffy digs me in the ribs and says, can you play in midfield? I lied and told him I could play anywhere. He then said, I'm putting you on. We haven't kicked off yet, but he's going to put me on. He identified a player who will remain nameless. It was Lemmy Robertson. Who... couldn't play. I told Cluffy he'd picked him, so it was his fault. We get through to half time, eruptions in the dressing room, I go on for the second half, we go to get on the coach to come home, and Cluffy wouldn't let Lammy onto the coach. He had to make his own way home. It was as simple as that. And I just, that together with Dr. Tabor resigned, I'd broken my collarbone. Doctor said I needed another couple of weeks rest. Cluffy told the doctor I'd got shoulders like Garth and I'd be training on Monday. So he resigned on the spot, and I'm thinking, what the hell have I done now? I just couldn't. People were afraid of him. People were afraid of Cluffy. I wasn't afraid of Cluffy.
But you weren't happy with him?
No, I'd got no respect for the guy. I respected Pat Sayward, the coaches and managers that I'd worked with, I had a respect for. Not this man. I think he was dishonest. I think he came to Brighton for 5,000 reasons. They were all pound notes. He'd got no interest in the club. But at the end of the day, he put the club on the map.
Mm.
You know, it was Brian Clough's Brighton.
Such a shame that you actually couldn't have actually been part of the journey onwards then.
I would have loved to, but I just could not abide the guy.
Could you have played under Peter Taylor?
Probably, yeah.
Right.
My view was that Peter was the brains behind Clough. Clough was the mouthpiece. At half time, Clough and Taylor would speak in the corridor in the treatment room before Clough came in and lambasted us. And he spoke what Peter Taylor had told him to say. It was as simple as that, in my opinion. So I would have loved to have seen out 3 years of my contract, but
Where did you go afterwards? I mean, obviously, clearly, it wasn't going to happen, and you left. So what did you do for the rest of your career?
Well, I went to see Mr. Clough and the club secretary and asked if I could be released from my contract. I was told in no uncertain terms that they keep my registration as a league player, but I asked if I could play non-league. They agreed to that. I joined the Eaton Borough, trained with the Eaton Borough, got a job working for Rolls-Royce in Coventry, the aero engine people, and was due to make my debut for Nuneaton on the Saturday. I asked their secretary to ring Alan Leather, Brighton secretary, to just clarify the situation. And unfortunately, Mr. Clough demanded money for me to allow me to play.
Charming. Mm. So after Nuneaton Borough?
Nuneaton, worked for Rolls-Royce for 5 years, played with Nuneaton for probably 5 or 6 years, went to join Peugeot Motor Company and spent the next 32 years there in various roles and managing.
Not missing people.
Football? I always miss football.
Even now.
I love the game in the 70s. It was an honest game.
For the most part.
I go up to watch Coventry. I'm a member of the Coventry Former Players Association. We get a couple of tickets for home games. So I go and watch them. I've got the worst seats in the ground. They face the pitch.
Whee! It's an oldie but a goodie. Now, you mentioned the player that couldn't be mentioned. I mean, here we are at Spencer Vignes's book launch. There's probably a couple of characters here that you've not caught up with for a long time.
Right.
What do you make of this evening's do, then?
I think it's been absolutely fabulous. I think Spencer's written a really well-balanced book. I thought maybe we came here tonight and it's part of the Oxford University Debating Society. Is Clough a saint or a sinner? It hasn't turned out that way. It's nice to get hold of Lammy, Sully.
Literally get hold of Lammy.
Yeah.
Have you kissed them made up?
He still owes me money. But he's a Scot, so you know, you take these things in your stride. But Peter O'Sullivan looks remarkable. I saw John Templeman at the Coventry Brighton FA Cup game, and Tempe's looking fabulous.
He still looks very young, doesn't
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. And little Tony Towner, my lasting memory of Tony, is strapping him by the ankles to the crossbar and taking shots at him. I shouldn't have done that. That was naughty.
What, because you kept missing?
Probably.
Ian Goodwin, it's been brilliant to catch up with you. Thanks very much indeed for spending some time on the Albion Roar.
Thank you very much for inviting me down.
Yeah, that's Ian Goodwin there. Started off at Coventry and finished his time here at the Albion. After that, AD caught up with longtime veteran Albion winger Peter O'Sullivan.
Welcome. Welcome to the Albion Roar.
Thank you.
It was quite a career you had with the Albion. That's a lot of games.
Yeah. It was a lot of games. And but you played under various different managers, some of them better than others for you, and it, looking through your history, it seems like you fell out with most of them. But we're here on a Clough Taylor evening, so tell us about your experiences under Brian Clough.
I can't really explain, but a lot of people didn't like Brian, but he was actually great for me, because he played me every game, and he thought I was a good player, and like I said, I played every game, so I thought, you know, and I respected him. I thought he was different class.
But you were at the Albion before he arrived, of course. So I mean, when you see this superstar rocking up at the Albion, and we interviewed the late great John Vinnicombe, who you would have known.
Yeah.
And he told us a story about Brian when he first arrived in Brighton. He turned up at Brighton station on the train, and he refused to get off the train until the car that was picking him up drove up to his carriage. and so all he had to do was walk off from the train straight into the car. Now, is that the Brian Clough that you envisaged turning up, or was he better than that for you?
Well, I don't know if he had the car going up to the station,
in the dressing room, that must have been like a seismic shock. Like, oh my God, Brian Clough's coming.
Well, yeah, it was a little bit bizarre when they got Cloughy, but I don't know. He was just, all I can say about Cloughy was he was a really good manager. Yeah. I thought he was. Well, for me, because I played every game.
So what did he do for you that was so special?
He told me I was a good player. Well, he obviously knew I was a good player.
Which everyone on the terraces knew already.
Well, yeah, everybody knew, but... Then you think, well, hang on a minute. Brian Clough's told you you're a really good player, you know what I mean? And it builds you up. And you think, oh, right, I'm a good player, you know. And I was probably playing in a very bad side, so...
Obviously, when he came, there was those two really bad defeats to start with, the Waltonham Hersham one and the Bristol Rovers one.
Yeah.
And it took a while for it to get going. But do you think if that Clough and Taylor partnership had stayed together at Brighton, we could have seen at the Albion what happened at Nottingham Forest?
I don't know really. I wouldn't like to commit myself to say that, because I think like Brian was never going to stay down here.
Yeah. Did you get the impression that he was not happy and he didn't want to be here?
Well, no, he was happy, but he was just you know, turn up on a Thursday afternoon and we'd train. And you know, he'd train. He'd actually train, believe it or not. Cloughy on a five-a-side we'd have on a Thursday, then we'd do a little bit of training Friday, and Saturday after the game, you know what I mean, you didn't see him again till the Thursday. And I think it was obviously if he'd have stayed here with Peter Taylor, then it might have been, you know, successful.
Do you think it really was a case of the fact that, I mean, the book that we're promoting tonight is called Bloody Southerners?
Yeah.
And do you think he just did not want to be in the South? He was more comfortable in the North?
Yeah, well, I think it was... Yeah, he was more comfortable up where he lived. And it was just, you know, and obviously the club, you know, kind of like stood for that, really. Yeah. You know what I mean? He was so big. That, you know, okay, you know.
I mean, it was a massive backward step for him, having been winning the championship and being in the European Cup.
Yeah.
And so for you, I mean, your career progressed, and you played under a succession of different managers. Clough, you said, was good for you.
Yeah.
How was Taylor as a manager after Clough had gone to Leeds?
Well, I think, like, Pete was fine. You know, Pete was fine, but he was another one. Like,
he was quite dour, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he had someone, I can't remember who it was, because he had someone that did the did the training, you know, whoever it was, you know, and Peter beat him in his office, and then they picked a side on a Saturday.
So do you think, I mean the players that Peter Taylor brought in, the likes of Brian Horton, of Peter Ward, his eye for a player, and this continued throughout his career. It happened at Derby, it happened at Brighton, it happened particularly at Nottingham Forest.
Yeah.
But those players he brought in here that formed the basis of that Mullery side that got us promoted and got you playing at a top level.
It was down to it was definitely down to Peter Taylor. I'll always say that, you know what I mean? But like at the end, when we didn't get promotion that in his last season, and we should have done, and well, he'd probably still gone to Forest with Brian, but when we didn't, and I think that swayed him a little bit, and he, you know, and then Muller's got the job, and then we got promotion.
And it was that side which was absolutely fantastic, and the nucleus of which that Taylor put together. That went on to call not only the promotion from that league, but onto the top level as well. So you think that if Taylor had got that promotion, he would have stayed?
Well, possibly, yeah. I think he might have done, actually. I shouldn't say that. What I'll say is, like, yeah, Peter would have probably stayed.
Now, your career went on to various different levels. You seemed to fall out of every manager you played for, which was...
I'll put this, you know... The only time I fell out with managers...
Is when they didn't pick you.
No. When I got, like, substituted, and I thought there was... And I thought, like, that I was possibly, you know, a good player. And then after that, you know, like, fall out, because I didn't want to... I wanted to play every game. Then I'd fall out with them, and you know, and maybe Arsenal, I'd say, oh, look, I'm just leaving here. Like, I can't be asked for this. But the frightening part about this is all of those managers that I fell out with come back to me and said, look, Sully, can you play? Will you come back and play now? Have you? So I always went back and played.
Yeah.
No, seriously.
And the Brighton public are so glad that you did, because you were a flair player, and you know, I mean, you were Brighton's George Best, to be honest.
Well, I don't think I was.
But yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, Mullers did come in, and you played really well, but you did leave, and you were kind of like a trailblazer for players that went to the States. How did that come about?
Well, I'll tell you how that came about. We've got promotion into the first division, where I'd played every game. The next season, the first season in the first division. After that, we went to America on like for about 3 weeks or something as a well done, you know what I mean? You've got promotion, we'll go to the States, you know what I mean? And
a proper Mike Bamber thing to do.
And play thing. And I think Mike was involved with someone else there on business. And we went to the States, and I played footy there. And then we played against San Diego. And I think we played against them, I think we drew 2-2, and I scored a great goal. You know, I remember Maybank chesting it down to me, and I volleyed it in the top corner. And I spoke to their owner afterwards, you know, and I said, I'm still a Brighton player. I said, I wouldn't mind coming out here, because San Diego was lovely.
Yeah.
Anyhow, like, cut a long story short, I played every game that season in the first division until the end, I think it was. And I got a phone call, and I was in a hotel in Stoke with Brighton. We were playing Stoke the next day or something like that.
Glamorous then.
Yeah. Mike was quite happy about it. And this Bob Bell said to me, look, I want to sign you. You know, I'd like to sign you for San Diego. So he'd obviously liaised with Bamba, and they were quite happy to, you know, get a few quid for me or something like that. And I said, fine, like, you know, I said, I'd love to, you know, like, and I said, well, come out here on Sunday. So I seen Bamba Saturday morning, and I was in the side to play Stoke, and he said, well, get yourself back to Brighton, and this is, honestly, this is a true story, get yourself back to Brighton, and get... He'll book a flight for you to go to San Diego on Sunday. So I went, okay, you know, because we'd arranged the finances.
Yeah.
And so I went back to Brighton, got the gear, said to my my
partner,
fiance. I'm going to San Diego. Yeah, so, you know, got the thing, got my tickets, you know, went to Heathrow, got up to Houston, got up to the thing, and then, I was actually transferred for like 50,000, and I didn't know, you know what I mean?
That's a lot of money then, though.
Yeah, 50,000. Then they had it in the program out there, you know, because of the dollar. Oh, we've just signed this guy from Brighton. For $250,000. So I was like, you know, I was like, me? Is it me?
So you like a kid in clover. So I mean, what playing wise, the standard over there probably wasn't quite the same, even though.
Well, it was fine for me because I think I was about 29, 28, 29. I think I was 29. I went out there and you were playing against, like, you know, bad players. George Best, Franz Beckenbauer,
Pelé.
Johan Cruyff. No, Pelé was like far too old. Hugo Sanchez, he played in the San Diego side, but he was about, he was about 12, but I think he was about 20, and he was in the side, you know what I mean? I thought, great goal scorer, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? And, they had Leonardo Cuellar there, the old bearded one. Yeah, so it was an experience playing against those players, you know. When you're in New York and playing against Beckenbauer, and they had, okay, Niskins was playing for them, and you see Franz playing, you know, you're playing against him, and he was like just a wonderful player, you know.
He was one of the world greats.
Oh, well,
he's got to be the best player you ever played against, presumably.
He's definitely the best player I've ever played against. Yeah.
Who was the best player you ever played against in this country?
Probably, talking about footballers, probably Hoddle or something like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he was a lovely player.
Yeah. But, I mean, you notoriously are not a watcher of football.
No, I don't like watching football.
And
I played football.
And, Peter, you are one of the greatest players ever to grace Brighton Hove Albion shirt, and we thank you for that.
Well,
and we thank you for your time now.
Thank you.
And... We'll catch up with you. We want to hear more of these stories. We love these stories when you can remember them.
Yeah, that's Aidy Packham talking to Peter O'Sullivan there. That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Thanks to all our guests who came onto the show. Matt Dawn, Jared Evans, Russell Guyver, Ian Goodwin, Peter O'Sullivan and more besides. We'll catch up with you next week. Cheers for now.